Okay, thanks. All right, so we've already heard a bit about waves and what they can do in stars. So I'm going to go into that in a little more detail and try to convince you that the waves, especially wave energy transport in massive stars, is a really important bit of new physics that has historically been left out of massive star evolution. I should say this is a pretty new idea. It's only really, Elliot Quadert had this idea a few years ago, and only a couple people have worked on this, so we're still trying to understand what the implications are. But there's a lot that needs to be done. I would say we have not at all validated or verified this physics. There's lots of evidence suggesting wave energy transport might be important, but people are just starting to work on it. So there's a lot more to be done before we really understand if we've implemented it well or totally wrong. Okay, so before I get going, actually, I need to ask for Rich Townsend's attention. Rich, you've won big. Rich was lucky enough to take $100 off of me in a bet last year, which I bet that LIGO would get the Nobel Prize for gravitational waves. I was too optimistic about that. So Rich won that bet. So I owe him $100. So I was going to get like one of those big giant checks print out, but that was going to cost $92. So it would have really depleted this endowment fund. We agreed this $100 would be used to set up a burrito endowment for starving graduate students to buy about 2 burritos per year. So Rich, come get your check.
I should add that this bet was revenge on Jim for pranking me big time that an unbalanced Macy user was traveling up the mountain climbing the hot tub with me.
That was hilarious.
So thank you very much, Jim.
So Daniel also made the same bet. He's not here today to collect his check. Too bad.
Do you have any more bets you want to make?
I learned my lesson. All right. Oh yeah, Rich, I should point out, if I find that you're skimming from this fund...
But how will you tell if I've eaten all the burritos? It's just Epsilon.
It's on your honor.
I'll ask your grad students. Okay, so back to waves. There's a lot of motivation on the observational side for some sort of new physics operating in the final decades or years of massive star lives. It seems like every week there's a new paper, usually from the supernova side, usually an observational paper, showing some sort of evidence for enhanced mass loss or dense CSM in the immediate vicinity of supernova progenitors. If you catch supernova really early, you're very likely to see some sort of signature of the ejecta running into some sort of CSM. And when people try to infer mass loss rates, this is not easy, but when they try to infer mass loss rates, they find that they're much larger than in the rest of stellar evolution. They can be much larger than 10 to the minus 3 sun per year. These are mass loss rates that might be enhanced by many orders of magnitude over the rest of stellar evolution. So that needs explanation. This is not usually predicted by stellar evolution codes. So we need to figure out what's going on there. Waves might be one solution in at least some cases. Okay, so even though I'm saying this is new physics, it's not really new physics, it's old physics. We know that convection excites waves. This is, you know, Tammy has done some very beautiful simulations. This is a nice simulation done by Andrea Christini of carbon shell burning in a massive star. This is the convective carbon burning shell. And up here, you see waves. These are internal gravity waves excited by this convection. So we know waves are excited by convection, but what I'm trying to convince you today is just that these waves, in at least some cases, are actually really important for the energy transport as well. Okay, so why does that happen in the late stages of massive star evolution? The basic idea is that, and there's a lot of uncertainty here, but we think that convection will excite waves carrying a flux of roughly the Mach number of the convection times the luminosity carried by the convection. That's something Daniel went into in a lot of detail last week. We don't understand the spectrum of waves extremely well, but I'd say this is sort of something we, a lot of people mostly agree on. This is about the energy you get out in waves. Now, in most phases of stellar evolution, the Mach numbers of convection inside, especially deep inside of the star, those Mach numbers are very small. They're often 10 to the minus 3 or so, or even smaller in deep interior. So that means that the amount, the fraction of the stellar luminosity that you put into waves is a tiny fraction of the total energy budget of the star. So accounting for that energy transport is not important. Basically, waves are negligible in most phases of stellar evolution. So what changes in mass of stars at the end of their lives is that they go into thermal disequilibrium. The reason for that is that at the end of stars' lives, massive stars, they start losing energy to neutrinos. Energy is no longer carried outward by radiation and convection alone. A lot of the energy from nuclear reactions ends up being radiated as neutrinos. And so that means basically the core of the star decouples from the envelope. It starts evolving on its own time scale, its own thermal time scale set by neutrino losses. And that thermal time scale can be quite short. And so you can get nuclear luminosities that are orders of magnitude larger than the luminosity radiated at the surface of the star. Okay, so actually there's two thermal time scales that are important here. There's a photon diffusion thermal time scale and a neutrino thermal time scale, and they're much different. So the consequence of this is that you can have nuclear burning generating 10 to the 10 solar luminosities or so in energy in the core of the star, but the surface of the star is only radiating 10 to the 5. Now, most of that energy gets radiated by neutrinos eventually, but you can still have convection carrying 10 to the 9 or 10 to the 10 solar luminosities of energy. And that means the amount of energy you put into waves can actually be really large. It can be 10 to the 7 solar luminosities or so. And that's much larger than the surface luminosity.
Just to be clear, L does not include neutrinos, or does include neutrinos? This is mainly neutrinos.
Right, so you can write it different ways. Yeah, so the total energy, yeah, so you can write it as the total energy generated or the total energy generated minus that carried away by neutrinos. Both can be much larger than the surface.
Both can be larger.
Yes. Yeah, so typically what happens is the energy is generated very close to the center of the star. So you do put a lot of energy into heating, which does drive vigorous convection. Eventually, that energy is radiated as neutrinos, but it's not instantaneous. That's right.
Quantitative on me, I'm going to come back and ask you again.
Well, I'm going to try to get at least a little quantitative, and that's, you know, I'm using MESA to do this,
right,
obviously.
You, so you're saying that the neutrinos were the dominant.
They're what's setting the time scale for all this.
Okay.
What's important in the calculations of waves is actually the energy carried by convection.
Right. So that's
which
right.
is, yeah. So, okay. Really, L con can also be much, much larger than L star. Okay.
It's not obvious that nu minus nu is much bigger than L star.
It might not be obvious, but in every stellar evolution code, that is what happens.
No, that's not true.
As far as I'm aware. Okay. So when does that not happen?
Well, you just said yourself that all of that energy comes out in neutrinos.
Eventually, yes.
That's right.
So you can have situations where that energy does not go into convection. One example is carbon burning in a 20 solar mass star that proceeds radiatively. So there are examples where you don't excite vigorous convection, but in most stars in many phases of evolution, neon burning, oxygen burning, carbon burning, do put a lot of.
If you don't have waves, all of that energy that goes into convection has to go somewhere, and again,
right.
It goes into neutrinos.
Right.
So,
yes.
So that's if you look at.
Right. So convection carries it out.
Might be right, but in a steady state, that's not
Right. So what matters for waves is the instantaneous energy carried by convection. Right. So you're right. In the absence of waves, energy will get carried out by convection, then eventually radiated as neutrinos. But we just care about the amount, the convective luminosity at any time step. That's what's important. So what I'm doing is using MESA to try to estimate these things, and hoping that MESA is giving me a realistic estimate of LConv, which I think it does, because it, you know, MESA does account for all the nuclear reactions, for neutrinos carrying away energy. Right. So MESA calculates, you know, an LConv and an L neutrino and an L nuke. And it adds all that up together to get an LConv, and that's what I'm using.
Okay. I have no idea what you just said, but that's okay.
Jim, if you show a profile,
yes,
it would become clear if you have a burning profile.
I will show some profiles.
It's a well-constructed convective zone, right?
That's right.
On average, the neutrino cooling is matched by the nuclear burning. But it's not spatially at every location.
That's right.
And so the only way you can get the sum to work is to have convective luminosity is going from A to B.
That's right.
It would be magic if L convective wasn't a border of the L neutrino.
Right.
I doubt there's any place where it's less than a factor of 100.
Yes.
But you look at a profile.
So yeah.
It doesn't match.
Yeah, so this is, it's funny, this little sticking point is the thing people ask the most questions about, but this is, I don't think there's anything magic. There's nothing new at this point. I think most stellar evolution codes will tell you you get vigorous burning and vigorous convection during these burning phases. So to give you some idea of these scales, this is a plot from Elliott's original paper on this idea. These are the approximate nuclear energy generation rates at different phases of evolution of, I don't know, 50 solar mass star. These are the durations, and these are the Mach numbers. So the amount of energy carried by convection is of order this magnitude times this Mach number roughly. So it's pretty easy to get luminosities of 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 8 during these phases. Okay, wave luminosities. Okay, now if you integrate over these timescales, the total amount of energy you can put into waves is of order 10 to the 47, 10 to the 48 ergs in a typical 15 solar mass star. So that can be greater than the binding energy of a red supergiant. So that's a lot, that could be very important. If that energy makes it out of the core, it's gonna do a lot of damage. Now this energy is much less than the binding energy of the core. So it's not going to do a lot, I think, to the core structure, but it can do a lot to the envelope structure. So to give you a little taste of this, this is a Kippenhahn diagram for a 15 solar mass star. The colored zones are convective regions, shaded by this L waves parameter, which is just the Mach number of the convection at any point, calculated from mixing link theory, times the convective luminosity at any point. Okay? So this tends to be less than the surface luminosity before carbon burning. Once you get to neon burning, late carbon shell burning, and oxygen burning, this number can be of order 10 to the 7 again. So the idea is that, say, during oxygen burning, you're exciting waves with the flux going out on the order of 10 to the 7 solar luminosities. And these waves propagate. These are internal gravity waves. They propagate in regions that are not convective, that are stably stratified like this. And in order to make it to the envelope, they need to change their structure a bit. So they actually need to, in order to be able to propagate out towards the surface of the star, they need to tunnel into acoustic waves. They need to change from gravity waves. Yeah.
Can we go back to the previous slide? So I'm just wondering whether I get this right or wrong. Waves propagate with the sound speeds.
No.
No. Uh-huh.
Internal gravity waves propagate at their group velocity which is omega squared r over root l times l plus 1.
Is it all the sound speed, or is it very different?
It's typically much smaller than the sound speed for gravity waves.
So a sound wave, I thought, would take from the center of the star to the surface of which that supergiant would take a year, is that right? Or of the order of...
That's right, yeah. All that travel time is out here in the envelope. But yes, it's a dynamical time. It's of order months.
A pulsation period of when supergiants can be up to 10 years, actually.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, it can be of order years or months. Depends on the size.
Does that mean then from the time of collapse, I should go back that time scale, and so everything which happens in that span of time will not make it to the surface?
Yeah, so that's a good question. It is really important that these sound speed crossing time scales are becoming comparable to the total lifetime of the star after that point. So yes, you have to include that, and that is something that is included in some of the work I've done. So we're putting in what you're going to see is we're putting in energy here, and in order to get out to the surface, you have to wait a sound speed crossing time for that to have any effect.
So all the red stuff really does not make it.
So this stuff, probably isn't going to do much at the surface. Also, once you get here, the wave luminosities are so large, I'm not sure that using linear theory to capture them is so great anymore. So I'm not going to make any statements about what happens in silicon burning, because I think there's a lot more that happens at that point.
When you do calculations, do you put instantaneous propagation of those waves, or you actually calculate it propagating?
So, in my models right now, I'm doing instantaneous propagation of gravity waves. The time that it takes gravity waves, because this core is really tiny, right? So, even though the gravity waves propagate at much slower than the sound speed crossing time scale of this part of the star is minutes. So I have calculated approximately how long it takes the gravity waves to propagate out of here, and maybe it's of order hours or days, but that is much shorter than the time until core collapse. So I'm treating that part as instantaneous. What we're going to see is the waves damp before they make it out into this far out into this envelope. So I'm not taking into account that delay and the propagation time because the waves damp before. You'll see. I'm getting there. So this is the toy picture. Convective core, that excites internal gravity waves. These internal gravity waves typically see a boundary due to the convective helium burning shell. In most stars, there's a convective helium burning shell above that. Because that's convective, the gravity waves can't propagate there, so they see that as a big boundary, preventing them from tunneling out, propagating out into the envelope. So the waves become evanescent here in this shell, and then the tail of the wave function that extends out to the surface basically tells you how much of that wave energy is able to then to make it out as acoustic waves and keep propagating out in the star. So that can be better quantified through a propagation diagram. So this is a propagation diagram for red supergiants during core oxygen burning. So you have two important frequencies. The red line is the Lamb frequency. That's basically sound speed divided by radius. The blue line is the Brunt-Weissalla frequency. And this black line is what I've calculated as the convective turnover frequency at this phase of evolution. That's on the order of 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 2. And so we expect waves to be excited roughly at this frequency. Of course, there is some spectrum. But these waves will behave as gravity waves in the shell around the oxygen-burning core. Here's that convective helium-burning shell. So the waves are going to be evanescent here because they have a lower frequency than the Lamb frequency, but higher frequency than the Brunt, which is approximately zero there. But out here in the envelope, these are going to behave as high-frequency acoustic waves.
What about the waves that are generated in the helium-burning shell?
So there are waves generated in the helium-burning shell as well. I have not tried to account for those in any of the work I've done so far, because usually the energies, the wave energies, are smaller than they are down here.
Yeah, but they're evanescent. You're losing amplitude hugely.
That's right. So that's a way to improve all this work, is to account for those. I have looked at that. I think it's hard to get 10 to the 7, even if you get all the flux, even if all the waves generated by this zone make it out here. It's not going to be of order 10 to the 7, which is what you can get from in here. 10 to the 7 is evanescence. Right, so
after you get the decrement.
I'll go into, you don't necessarily lose all that decrement, all that evanescent decrement. So I'll go into that. Okay, so the waves are going to make it out here. Once they're out here, I mean, this is this extremely diffuse red supergiant envelope. The wave frequency is much, much larger than Lamb frequency. So these will turn into very high order sound waves, very short wavelength. And in addition, the density falls like brick out here. So that amplifies the wave amplitude. So this is going to cause the waves to dissipate as they get out into the envelope. So I'll quantify that in a bit. But they're not going to make it all the way out to the surface. Okay, so here's some of the details of what I've actually done. So I'm trying to put wave energy transport into MESA and have that basically as an extra energy transport term at each time step in MESA. So what I do is at each time step, I calculate the approximate convective velocity in each convective zone. This is basically from mixing link theory. Then I calculate corresponding convective turnover time scale, which is of order just that convective velocity divided by scale height. And you can argue about factors of two here. But that's approximately the convective turnover frequency. And now this is the part that's going to make Tammy cringe. I assume all the waves have this frequency. There, of course, they'll actually have some spectrum extending to both lower and higher frequencies, but I'm assuming they get a lot of the power gets put into roughly this frequency, which is this black line on this plot. I'm also assuming most of the power goes into L equal 1 waves. Again, you put power into L equal 2, L equals 3, etc. But for these core convective burning phases, the convective structures do have pretty large spatial extents, and so I believe, Tammy, in your simulations and a lot of the other ones I've seen, the wave power is peaked at low values of L equal 1 and 2. So a lot of the power...
All of the energy in those frequencies and those wavelengths.
That's right. For starters, yeah, that's what I've done. There are, as we'll see during this talk, there are a lot of ways to improve this, but, you know, this is a first step. Nobody's done this at all up to this point.
The Mach number you use to characterize the convection is the Mach number of this scale?
It is. So the Mach number is this convective luminosity divided by sound speed.
The numbers which were in this table by Elliott.
So I don't use I calculate that at every time step in my models. But these are typical numbers.
For these large scales.
What do you mean for the large scales?
So
mixing length is really tells you about the large eddies. It's the Mach number of the largest eddies.
That's not L equals 1, is it? I mean, L equals 1 would be larger than pressure scale height, presumably.
It's core, remember. There's no...
Yeah.
The radius is the scale height, is R.
Okay. Yeah.
It's core convection, it's not a shell. So there's no small wing scale.
But you're talking about the horizontal length scale.
Yes. Yeah, so I mean, an important thing to do is to look at simulations and quantify how much wave power is put into each L. That's something we can try to do better. But certainly a significant fraction, a large fraction, is going into low Ls. Okay. All right, so the next thing I try to do is I try to calculate how much of this wave energy actually is able to tunnel through that helium shell, evanescent region, and escape into the envelope as acoustic waves. Okay, so the way I do that is I try to account for sources of wave damping, and there's a couple that I've included so far. The first, and I think most important for core convective phases, is actually neutrino damping. The way this works is gravity waves, even though they don't compress material very much, they're mostly incompressive, they do compress material a little bit when they propagate through it. That increases the rate at which neutrinos carry away energy from those regions. So you can calculate how much induced neutrino emissions the wave create as they compress material, and you get this expression. So this gives you basically a local neutrino damping rate for the waves at each point. So that's a damping term that saps wave energy. Another thing that can happen is that waves which propagate back towards the center of the star in a shell burning phase, those can become geometrically focused and become nonlinear, and those can break. So waves tunneling into the center of the star during a shell burning phase give you another damping term here. And then if you actually do the math, you can quantify the effect of these damping terms. They become more important if the transmission into the envelope is small. So this is this transmission coefficient, the amount of wave flux that's able to tunnel through that evanescent region every time a wave hits that boundary. It's basically an integral over an evanescent wave number through that zone. So if this number is very small, that means not very much wave. That means the wave energy has a hard time tunneling through. That makes this whole number large. This is the whole damping term. That means you, this whole thing in brackets becomes large. Raise it to the minus one power. So the amount of energy that escapes becomes small. So this is my escape fraction, which I'm calculating at every time step in MESA.
But it means that your wave is damped in the helium convection zone, then it...
So it's not actually damped there. It becomes evanescent.
Yeah, okay.
So there's no energy loss.
There's no energy loss. So I was just wondering whether the energy is deposited into the helium.
So it's, no.
Where does it go then?
It reflects. If it doesn't tunnel through, it reflects. The first order, that's what happens. And that's basically just linear wave propagation theory. That I think we understand linear wave propagation theory in spherical symmetry pretty well. That's why astroseismology works at all. And that's mostly what I'm doing here. Yeah, Bill.
Back up to the partial first equation.
Yeah.
What's the primary source of neutrinos is dominating that, and how sensitive is it to temperature?
So this number I've looked, I think, is of order 10.
So which flavor of neutrinos are?
I'm not sure.
But it's not the nuclear reaction ones. It's one of the thermal sources.
I believe that's true. Yeah. Yeah, maybe Frank knows.
Yeah, it's thermal.
Okay.
Yeah, thermal.
Yeah, but which thermal?
Give me 1 second.
Okay.
If you play the same games with the helium burning shell, do the waves from the oxygen core affect the burning of the helium burning shell?
Potentially. I mean, there has been a little work. I know Arnett and Meekin have looked at simulations of oxygen burning, and they see they have a carbon shell burning region and an oxygen shell burning region, and they see waves go out and try to tunnel through each region. So there is some interaction. It's not clear if that has any big effect on the convection or not. That's another question to be answered. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of wave energy tunneling through these regions. It might affect the convection in those regions a little bit.
Experiments would suggest that's true.
Okay. So that's something I have not looked at yet, but could be a very interesting effect.
Probably plasma neutrinos. Okay.
Okay, so now I'm going to show you some of the results. I tried to just focus on sort of the most vanilla stellar model I could find. This is a non-rotating 15 solar mass model I made in MESA, but with all these wave heating effects added. So here are some of the luminosities. Everything, a lot of these plots you're going to see, the x-axis is time until core collapse. And in this plot, the black line is our nuclear energy generation rate. It's a little different from the convective luminosity, but they're similar order of magnitude. So you see these spikes that occur when different burning phases begin, which I've labeled. Okay, now this blue dashed line is the amount of wave energy that I'm calculating is able to be generated and then escape into the envelope during each of these phases. So this is basically the wave heating rate of the envelope at each of these phases.
Have you checked just sort of back at the envelope how rotation would affect the vertical propagation of these waves? Because presumably that affects it in a big way and would increase the time scale quite a bit. But I don't know. I mean,
I'm not sure how it would change the time scale. So you could get some, I think, to first order rotation will be important if the rotation frequencies are comparable to the convective turnover frequencies and therefore the wave frequencies. So that could happen, but that depends on the rotation rates of these cores, which we don't necessarily know. So I think it's possible that rotation can modify these dynamics if you get rotation rates of order 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 hertz in the core.
So it's core rotation resistance more than
right. I think where rotation will be most important is affecting the internal gravity waves and the radiative shells around the core, and then also the convection in the core itself. Rotation is a whole nother bag of worms I have not added yet.
But you're saying that basically you just think that unless it's rotating really fast, it's not going to affect the propagation. Because I'm not even thinking of the generation. That's a whole other issue. But I'm thinking of the waves are now more horizontal.
Right. So we understand roughly how rotation affects internal gravity waves. It turns, you can approximate it pretty well with the traditional approximation. Those effects become important if the rotation frequency is larger than the wave frequency. That's when rotation becomes very important. So we know sort of how to model that, say, in main sequence stars that are pulsating and rotating rapidly. And that could happen if these cores rotate rapidly. That could affect these dynamics.
We don't know how to model that, right? And I mean, that's why they can't actually pick out, I mean, they haven't been able to identify whether it's a fast rotating astro-seismology, right?
So no, this is something Connie talked about. They have, for a lot of these gamma dwarf pulsators, which are pretty rapidly rotating and are pulsating in G modes, they're learning how to identify all the modes and then, it's still, you have to be careful when you look at that data, but yeah, they can do it and they can identify the modes pretty reliably.
Drawing a line between the whether we can understand the theory of how rotation affects modes and whether we can robustly detect patterns in modes in rapidly rotating stars. The pattern recognition that fails, not the theory. It's our ability to recognize sequences of modes with consecutive radial orders that is a problem in rapidly rotating stars. Not per se our ability to model the effects of rotation on the modes from a theoretical standpoint.
In the traditional approximation.
Yes.
Or beyond.
Or even, you don't even have to use the traditional approximation. There are codes that don't use it.
There are very few 2D codes, for example, that include rotation and calculate mode, frequencies. There's only like two, right? I mean, the
two and a half.
Okay. and very little has been published from either of the two that I don't know about the half, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So I would say that's not actually a theory that's well done. You're saying it is.
Well, we know what the physics is.
Okay.
the numerics is challenging, but we know what the physics is. The reason why I think more people don't do the 2D cases for the 2D models, it's really a question of how well does your quasi-1D stellar evolution code give you a meaningful model that it's worth spending all of the effort to calculate the pulsation frequencies of.
I see.
Yep.
Your estimate of the damping the tunneling effect is based on a linear approximation.
That's right.
And this region is convective with nonlinear amplitudes. So don't you expect some additional dispersion or loss of coherence of your waves?
Yeah, so there could be some, yes, so those are nonlinear effects. There could be some nonlinear effects that affect the wave propagation through that region, yeah. Basically, wave convection interactions. It could be important. I think if the wave luminosity through that convection region is a lot larger than the convective luminosity, then you might expect the waves to not feel the convection too much. And that's often the case in these models, but that's something to look at.
How different is the convective turnover time in that other, I mean, because you kind of optimized for interaction, I would think, unless the convective turnover, in your picture, the frequency.
So they're quite different. The turnover frequencies at the center are generally larger than in the helium shell. So those waves will see essentially frozen convection as they're trying to tunnel through there. But yeah, that interaction has not been well quantified.
Why do you have four carbon earnings?
That's like 1,000 years. And you can see even during carbon shell burning, the luminosity I'm calculating, the heating rate due to waves, is pretty small. So it's totally negligible, I'd say, up until carbon shell burning. That's when waves are first starting to make their effects.
Because there seems to be some evidence that enhanced mass loss occurs already, like hundreds of years before.
Right, yeah. So there's a range of timescales that people have estimated for when the enhanced mass loss happens. In a lot of cases, it's more like hundreds or thousands of years before core collapse. And I would say it's hard for waves to explain that. Because, at least according to these calculations, they don't have much of an impact until basically the last decade or so. You know, you can get slightly different results for different mass models, but it's roughly the last decade when waves become important. So this red line down here, this is the surface luminosity of this model, which I'll get to how I calculate that, but you can see that most of this wave heat, even though it makes it out of the core, does not end up being radiated at the surface. So you do get some modulation, but you don't get a huge outburst from this wave heating, at least in a red supergiant. So these are total wave energies deposited as a function of time. You see where you first get a lot of energy is neon burning right here. You suddenly get a lot of wave heat. That can be of the order of 10 to the 47 ergs. And then by the end of oxygen burning, we're getting on the order of 10 to the 48 ergs total wave heat into the envelope of this model. That's comparable to, this is the binding energy of the entire hydrogen envelope. This is the binding energy of the outer solar mass. So it's certainly enough energy to unbind quite a bit of mass. Okay, so to actually account for the wave heat, what I do is I first calculate that wave heating term. And then I try to calculate how that wave heat is distributed through the model. So at each grid point, there's some wave heat deposited per unit mass, which is, you know, you can calculate a damping mass of the waves. There's a few effects that can damp the waves. One is radiative diffusion. As they propagate out, their wavelength shrinks because they're propagated into low sound speed regions. The second thing that happens is the density goes way down, so the wave amplitude goes way, way up. And that makes the waves become quite nonlinear. So for the models I'm showing you here, what I've done is I've calculated this damping rate due to the radiative diffusion that happens as the wavelength decreases. So there's an effective damping mass due to that process, given by this big equation, which depends on density and temperature and sound speed and things like that. But what's most important here is that this damping mass is proportional to density cubed, When the waves propagate out of the helium core and into the hydrogen envelope, the density, so look at this dashed line here, this is this 15 solar mass model, the density goes from about 1 to about 10 to the minus 7 at that location. So that means this damping mass changes by many orders of magnitude. So this plot shows this effective damping mass, the amount of mass acoustic waves have to propagate through before they damp. It's some very large number inside of the core and some very small number outside of the core. So basically, when the waves try to go out of the core, they become damped.
Can you explain why that comes in at density Q?
So there's a couple. So it's basically, let's see, where do all the factors come from? So there's a thermal diffusivity here, which has a density to the minus 2, I think. And then this damping mass, so this is one of the rows comes through just because it's the amount of mass in each shell. The sound speed and wave frequencies come in because that affects the wave number, so that affects the total damping rate is basically wave number squared times thermal diffusivity. So that tells you how much mass you have to go through to damp the waves, and the thermal diffusivity goes as rho to the minus 2. So that's...
What does sigma S be?
That's just Stefan Boltzmann constant. Yeah. And then this is a specific heat and an opacity. So these tell you these are related to the thermal diffusivity.
So Jim, it's an extremely high wave number. So at the place, it goes from the top of the helium zone to the bottom of the hydrogen zone, that cliff, the density cliff.
That's right.
Radial wavelength of the sound wave at that frequency is much smaller than the scale height.
Yes.
I'm trying to understand, so you don't have to worry about a reflection transmission problem there?
So you would, so that...
I mean, a sound wave that could in the water reflects back in, it doesn't go into the air.
Right.
You've got a density contrast that's much higher.
So that is a density contrast that's really sharp in mass, but actually in radius, it doesn't look so sharp.
Right.
So if you got a lot of reflection, I think what you would need for that is you'd effectively need a spike in Brunt.
I'm just saying if the wavelength of the...
I understand, yeah. So I don't think you get a lot of reflection because really in radius, this is actually a fairly smooth transition. Okay. So the waves hit this cliff and damp. So they deposit their heat. Okay, so what does that heat actually do to the star? That where the waves damp, so this is the integrated heating rate. It's basically zero in the core and goes up to 10 to the 7 at this interface.
Can you go back one figure?
Yeah.
I want to understand this. What is rho O burn?
So this is density before, so dashed line is density during carbon burning.
Right.
Yellow line is going to be my density during oxygen burning, and this includes wave heating effects.
And that's why you have this big density inversion?
So I'll get into what this is.
Okay.
But yes, basically the waves have affected the density profile of this model. Okay. So I'm trying to put all this into MESA and see what happens. And this is difficult because the wave heating rate can actually be so intense that it throws the star out of hydrostatic equilibrium. The waves can heat up regions so fast that their pressure increases and they're no longer in hydrostatic equilibrium. So I'm running MESA with hydrodynamics on to try to account for the pressure increases the waves can create and the pressure waves and shock waves that those can generate. So that's what makes all of this fairly challenging. So I'm just going to show you a MESA run.
Is it just all gas pressure, not radiation pressure?
It's both. Both are included in these simulations.
At the beginning it's gas pressure for sure.
They heat up regions quite a bit though. I think where the waves end up damping do end up becoming radiation pressure dominated in at least some cases. So you're going to see a radiation pressure driven wind inside of this star. which there are some multi-D effects that are going to change that picture, but that's what you'll see in these sims. Okay. So this starts at core carbon burning. This is, the star's not doing much yet. Okay, I'm going to pause it. So now we're in carbon shell burning. So I want to point you to this upper right panel, which shows the local luminosity, convective plus radiative, at each point in the star. And then the yellow line is the integrated wave heating rate. So what we're seeing is at this stage, the convective luminosity in this carbon-burning shell is about 10 to the 8 at its peak. Some of that power goes into waves, which propagate out of the core and heat up. They mostly damp at this kink in this curve because this is a log plot. So this is where the waves are depositing their heat. At this stage, it's at 30 solar radii or something. So that's still well below the surface of the star, which is at 1,000 solar radii, roughly. Yeah, about 1,000. Okay, so that's carbon shell burning. This wave heating rate is still more than an order of magnitude smaller than the surface luminosity, so the waves aren't doing much at this point. This bottom right panel is a velocity profile. We're seeing velocities at this point that are very subsonic. So the waves do make the envelope expand a bit, but not a lot. Yeah?
The orange curve is the wave luminosity.
It's the integrated heating rate.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
So basically at this point, the waves haven't deposited much heat, but as you go out, they're damping, they're depositing more heat.
Okay.
And then out here, they've all damped, so they're not depositing any more heat as you go out.
And the velocity units are CGS?
Yes. CGS, same with rho, log rho. Okay, so going along. Now you're going to see neon burning kick in. Okay, when neon burning kicks in, those convective luminosities go to about 10 to the 10. This makes the wave luminosities more than 10 to the 7. That's what I'm calculating. And that damps, now they're a little higher frequency. Those waves damp a little bit further in at about 10 solar radii. That's where most of the heat is deposited. You see that as they deposit heat, they increase the pressure of that region. That drives a pressure wave, which is then going to propagate out through the envelope at basically the sound speed. Okay, so that's what this, now you see the velocity scale has gone up to 10 to the 6. Okay, so now we're actually getting pretty substantial velocities. This is still subsonic at this point in the star, but you're going to see that pressure wave propagate out and form a little shock right at the surface, which you can't really see here, but it forms, as it gets near the surface, the density goes down, this wave is amplified, this pressure wave is amplified, you form a weak shock. So there's not much at this point. You'll see that develop during oxygen burning. As this pressure wave is breaking out of the surface, you're going to see the luminosity of the star go up, the luminosity and the temperature. So this is basically a shock breakout, but it's a very weak shock. Okay, so in these calculations, the luminosity increases by a factor of 2 or so, 2 or 3.
But at this point, the acoustic wave is spherical?
So all the waves are damping down here. They are definitely not spherical because they have to be L of 1 or greater. But I'm depositing the energy in a spherical manner. That might be appropriate if you have enough waves such that they average out spherically. You know, you have waves that are non-spherical, but the direction of that non-sphericity is changing all the time because they're stochastically excited. So yeah, in reality, the energy deposition cannot be spherically symmetric, but on average over time, it might be approximately spherically symmetric. But yeah, there's definitely non-spherical, there's multidimensional effects that might change this picture a bit.
So don't go back to it, but earlier you had a luminosity versus time at the different burning phases, and it didn't seem like there was that much of an increase in the luminosity. Was that a different model, or?
It had a bump.
Oh,
yeah. During carbon shell burning, there's a really tiny bump.
Okay.
Now we're at neon burning. The bump gets a lot bigger.
I thought, all right, maybe it was.
But it's still not huge. This is like a factor of two.
Right.
Factor of and three, the, maybe.
When the place where the wave, where the waves get damped, what is the L of the waves? Is it low or high?
The angular wave number L?
Yeah.
So again, this is all the waves here are L equal 1 waves.
Okay.
So let's say you decrease the total amount by a factor of 10 to 100 because of a spectra, because you assume there's a spectra and not everything's going in.
That could also increase the amount, but yeah.
Possibly. Okay, but let's just say you decreased it by a factor of 10 or so.
Yeah.
Does this, what?
I'm going to show you how that changes a bit. Yeah. So there is a lot of uncertainty in the total wave heating rates. So I'll show you at least a little bit how that affects these results.
So you're saying that you basically have low order L modes, but they're stochastically excited and they all have different axes of symmetry. So
right.
On average, they could look kind of spherically symmetric. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. Again, that needs to be quantified better. Yeah. Unless there's fast rotation, there's no obvious direction that's affecting the wave propagation, but maybe there's something surprising that could develop. Okay, so we see this little shock breakout during neon burning. Now in this model is going to go to oxygen burning. Again, the wave luminosities are on the order of 10 to the 7. And so now what we're seeing is that these velocities here are becoming very large. Now 10 to the 8, so that's 1,000 kilometers per second inside of the star. But then those velocities go back down because what's happening here is the wave heat is so intense that it's driving a wind off of the surface of this helium core. But that wind is then running into this 10 solar mass or 7 solar mass overlying envelope. So this wind can't escape, so it's lifting off this envelope. It's basically inflating this empty bubble inside of the star that's lifting off this envelope. So what that means is you have a huge density inversion here. And this is going to be Rayleigh-Taylor unstable. So this is what you get in 1D. In multi-D, it's not clear what's going to happen. Certainly, I think this density inversion will be washed out. This material will be mixed. It's not clear exactly how this will affect the energy transport in the convective envelope, but it will look a little different than this, that's for sure.
It's all convectively unstable there anyway.
So this is all, yes. So that's another really important effect, actually, in all of this, is how do you treat convection once you suddenly start adding a lot of heat to a region? So these models, what I'm doing is I'm limiting the acceleration of the convective, of the mixing link convective velocity to the local gravity. But in reality, it's not clear how the convection will respond. It can't respond instantaneously to this huge added energy input. So what happens is not clear. If I don't restrict the convective acceleration, then basically the convection is just able to transport all this wave heat out. So I don't think that's physical, but what is the correct answer? I don't know. So that can actually have a big impact on the results. So that's an important caveat in all of this. How does this convection in the envelope respond to this sudden heating? Okay. So this is again showing this pressure wave that's excited at the base of the hydrogen envelope during neon burning, propagates out, and then when it gets to the surface, forms a little shock, that breaks out, increases the surface temperature, and it makes some material to try to start flowing away from the surface of the star. Now in this particular calculation, that material only gets up to 20 kilometers per second or so. The escape velocity from this model is like 40 kilometers per second. So it's not quite unbound. It starts to expand, but it actually, this material does not escape all the way in that particular calculation. So this is surface temperature and radius as a function of time. Again, this is that pressure wave breakout. And after that, you get an expansion of the envelope. So those are the predictions of this model. This, at least in this model, the main effect is this neon pressure wave breakout.
Jim, this looks, you have 1200 R sun.
Yeah.
Everything happened. So this is right. 15. Did you have a low alpha for the?
Right. So the base photospheric radius is pretty big for this model. Part of the reason, so I'm using mixing length alpha of 2. Also, this is a 15 solar mass model, but I used some overshoot during the evolution. So I would say it behaves more like a 17 solar mass model compared to some of the other ones I've seen in the literature.
What should the radius be?
Right. So a lot of radii people are inferring is more like 500. But again, most type 2P supernova are coming from probably lower mass or effectively lower mass stars than this. So that's on my to-do list, is how does this happen with a more compact lower mass progenitor? Okay, so here's the HR diagram evolution. It's color-coded by time until core collapse. So if without wave heating, you basically the star would just sit here during its last 100 years. And these models are predicting a pretty big change in the last year or so. Again, that's mostly due to this neon burning pressure wave breakout. Okay, now during oxygen burning, again, you have this wind that's launched from the surface of the helium core at a couple R sun. You can see, so this purple line is the mass as a function of radius of this model. The total mass in this region is essentially nothing. It's much less than a solar mass, like 10 to the minus 2 solar masses. All the mass in this model is in this envelope above this empty bubble where the wind is. So to give you some idea of what the star might actually look like, so this is a 2D projection of a 1D stellar evolution meant to model a three-dimensional star. You can see time is going. Now we get to neon burning, and all of a sudden this pressure wave breaks out of the surface, makes the surface layers expand. Now we're in oxygen burning, and it's blowing this wind off the surface of the core in here. So you have this empty bubble, and then this hydrogen envelope surrounding it. But again, that will be washed up somewhat by Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities. So that's the prediction, at least so far. Now this can have a pretty big impact on the density profile of your star at core collapse. So this is black line is density profile without wave heating. And these colored lines are density profiles with wave heating. And Tammy, to help answer your question, so these eta's, these are just fudge factors, adjusting the amount of wave heat that I'm adding to my model. So eta equals 1 is my fiducial model, eta equals 1/3 is lowering it by a factor of 3, eta equals 3 is raising it by a factor of 3. And you can see the results are pretty different. So at eta 1/3, there's not a huge effect. Yeah, there's no bubble for one thing, and your surface doesn't expand by that much. For eta equal 3, there's a huge bubble, and you drive a huge wind. In this case, the pressure wave, when it breaks out, is actually able to unbind quite a bit of mass, and so you basically eject this wind off of the surface of that star. These dots are where the photosphere is.
What's the physical argument for eta equals 3?
There's not a good one. These are just.
I mean, I can see why it might be smaller than your, and I would think by even more than 1/3, but I can't see why it would be larger.
So it could be larger if a lot of the wave power is actually going into higher frequency waves than the convective turnover. This is something you see in your simulations. Those higher frequency waves are less damped in the core and see a smaller evanescent region to tunnel through. So the escape fraction for those higher frequency waves can be a bit larger.
But the wavelengths would be smaller.
So they'll damp, yeah, so once they turn into acoustic waves, they'll damp a little deeper. That's true. Okay. And that is not taken into account by this ADA. So the point is, there is a range of, I think, plausible outcomes of this. And there is quite a bit of uncertainty in this heating rate, and that does manifest as some uncertainty into how big of an effect this actually has on the star.
If you had done it at 20,
yeah.
This case looks like it's on the edge. Just given
on the edge? Oh, on the edge of ejecting mass from the surface.
So if you had just done it at 20.
Yeah. Haven't done a 20 yet.
But I presume it's much further away from this cliff. I mean, there's a mass, which this calculation would imply is there's a mass below which the post-optimistic calculation wouldn't have an impact. But there's a mass above which you don't have to worry so much about the details because it's robust. That's my presumption.
How do you know that?
Because the little velocities are all higher. Everything scales with the mass. You've got
sort of. The neon burning luminosities aren't so different.
Sorry?
I don't think the neon burning luminosities are so different. But the oxygen, yeah, definitely oxygen-burning luminosities are quite a bit different.
Right.
But you also have less time.
I understand. Okay, so it's not obvious to you.
I would guess there's a bigger effect for those higher mass stars, but I haven't explored the whole parameter space. So I have done a 12 solar mass model. I didn't do it very carefully, but I have. I can show you a result from that at the end. Okay. Okay, do we? Yeah, okay, we have a bit more time. Okay, so strip stars. So what happens if that hydrogen envelope isn't there anymore? Which is, of course, the case for 1b, 1c progenitors, and for the most part, 2b progenitors. So this is something I'm currently working on, is trying to figure out what happens in that case. So the basic effect is that in that case there's no hydrogen envelope, so now where the waves damp, so I switched the way I plot this a bit, but now where the waves damp is this, where this purple line has a kink. Now I'm plotting this as a function of exterior mass. So where the waves damp, there's only about 1/1000th of a solar mass exterior to them. So now, and the binding energy at that point is like 10 to the 45, it's much less than the amount of energy the waves can transport. So for these strip stars, the expectation is that now the waves can easily unbind the surface layers, and so what will happen is that they will basically launch a wind, a super Eddington continuum-driven wind, very similar to what Elliot has modeled and what he and San have been talking about. So the optical depth at this point is still quite large. But the mass isn't so large, and so there's plenty of energy to drive off these layers. So I don't want to say much here except that the time scale, the thermal time scales above this region are quite short. Now they're much, instead of being much larger than the time until core collapse, the thermal time scales at the wave damping location are now much shorter than the time until core collapse. So that means potentially you can observe a lot more of that wave heating as photons. Okay, so let me show you a run for, this is the same model as I showed you before, but now I artificially removed the hydrogen envelope. So it has essentially the same helium core mass. So this total star mass is 5.3, but it's basically the same helium core mass as what we had before. Okay, so carbon burning, not much happening. Oh, there was actually a bit happened. it's not extreme. I mean, these are like 10% variations. But now, so the wave heat was comparable to the surface luminosity, or to 10% of it. So you did get some variation there at carbon shell burning. Okay, now we're at neon burning. Now things go pretty crazy. You can see.
Write your autographs.
This is the start of the horse. You're going to see the horse being drawn and ordered. So now, during neon burning, the luminosity now goes up by a factor of several. And you can see what's actually happening is the waves are damping about here. They are driving a wind off the surface. This wind has a velocity on the order of 500 kilometers per second in this calculation. And so this is basically a super Eddington.
Is this pure helium now? There's no hydrogen.
This is pure helium. There's no hydrogen. Yeah. During this outburst phase, this effective temperature goes way down, and the luminosity goes way up. And that's because the photosphere is now way out in this optically thick wind.
Why is it the opposite when you have the hydrogen envelope? The outbursts went hotter.
That was because in that case we had a shock wave that was breaking out of the surface. In this case, there's not really a shock wave, there's basically a wind that's optically thick and at large radii. So that is because the photosphere is at large radii, you get adiabatic losses.
So here the star has adjusted its radius, right?
Right. Here the star has adjusted its radius before it hadn't adjusted its radius.
But the hydrostatic surface is still pretty much the same, or is it just a photospheric wind, a false photosphere in the wind?
That's right. So the photosphere, I'd have to look. So I evolved these models out to above the photosphere. But the photosphere is out here somewhere at radius of on the order of 100 solar radii.
And what are the mass loss rates?
I'll show you in a second. Yeah. They're significant. Oops. So I'll go back. Okay, so carbon shell burning, neon burning. We developed pretty much a steady state wind because the wave luminosities here, I think, are high enough for the steady state wind solution to exist. As neon burning peters off, the wave heating rate is going to go down, and you're going to see the steady state wind solution disintegrate. That's about to happen. At this phase, this is similar to, I think, that intermediate case that Stan has looked at, where you don't get the steady state wind, you get the material's trying to escape, but it can't make it all the way off. It falls back. There's all these shocks. So this is actually really a pain for these evolutions because you have all these shock waves in the model and it has to take really small time steps. It was not easy. Took a lot of fiddling. But at least, you know, we have some. At least now we have a baseline.
So those are all going to be really tailored and stable too, right? A lot of fallback.
So during the fallback stage, yes. In the steady state wind phase, I don't think so.
But I meant that fallback.
But during this fallback stage, which again is about to start, yeah, this is all Rayleigh Taylor unstable. I think multi-dimensional instabilities are going to be very important during this phase. So I wouldn't believe all this jittering that you're going to see here. I'm not really sure what the star would look like at that phase. Okay, so I'm going to skip forward. This goes on for a long time. I want to show you the bottom part of the horse. This is all still the body of the horse, but we don't get to the rest till after oxygen burning, which hasn't even started. So maybe I can show you that at the end if we have time. Okay, so this is the same plot as I showed you before, but now for the strip star. The wave heating rates are very similar, but now we're getting more luminosity coming out as photons. Coming out of this wind. But it's still not extreme. In this model, it's still less than 10 to the 6 solar luminosities. So this is an outburst, but it's not a huge one. It's the kind of outburst that could very easily be missed by transient surveys. Probably would be missed. Unless it's very nearby.
Well, but the color totally changes.
The color totally changes.
The luminosity may not be the right measure.
Good point.
It's a red supergiant. It's a fourth blue
supergiant. No. It's yellow. It was very blue, and now it's sort of yellow, yeah. Yeah.
That's just because of the optical thick wind.
That's right. Yeah. Okay, so this is a profile of that wind. You can see escape terminal velocities on the order of 500 kilometers per second. And the mass in that wind at any time, the mass in the optically thick part of that wind might be of order 10 to the minus 3. And that's basically where the waves damp. Okay, so there's a lot going on in this plot. These are different luminosities as a function of radius in this model. So here's convective luminosity in the core, it's about 10 to the 10. This is what I'm calculating as wave luminosity, about 10 to the 7. It damps, the waves damp here. So the amount of energy they carry goes down. That energy is put into advective and radiative luminosity that are carried out by this wind. Although you'll see that these do not add up to the wave energy. That's because most of this energy is actually used to just lift off this material to unbind it.
Why is the wave, so the wave energy, I'm thinking it should be Mach number times whatever that is. So that's 10 to the minus 3, yeah?
So maybe, yeah.
But then it should damp before it damps in the late, you know.
So really damp. This is L heat. So I'm just, what I do is I calculate the amount that escapes through here, and then I just draw a straight line, basically, up until the point when it starts damping. Now, one thing I've done here is now, so there's a paper by Stephen Rowe and Chris Massner that showed for these high wave luminosities, really what will damp the wave is shock formation. They'll form shocks, and that will be what damps them. So in this calculation, I've tried to include that shock damping of the waves.
So the blue curve, the L advective, that's just kinetic energy, the luminosity of the wind?
It's kinetic plus the enthalpy term.
The enthalpy, but not the gravitation
term. I have to look. I forget if the gravitational is included in there or not. By the time you're out here...
The gravitational, they should all add up to the energy put in. So.
Oh, right.
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, I put on a, I didn't put it on this plot. I've looked at the gravitational energy term, and I think that gets you the right answer. Okay, so here's the horse. Basically what happens is so I don't think you should believe all this, but basically if the star didn't have wave heating, it would just sit down here. During neon and oxygen burning, where you're having large heating rates, the star goes up here somewhere, where it's much lower temperature, but much higher luminosity. The feet of the horse, this happens in this model after oxygen burning. I think what's happened, I have not looked at this in detail yet, I think what's happened is that it's unbound so much mass that the core below it now expands adiabatically a little, and that actually decreases the surface luminosity after oxygen burning. But I have to look at that. I think the main point here is that during these wave outbursts, there's basically a low hard state where the temperature is large, there's not much wave heating, the radius, the photospheric radius is small. But during these wave heating phases, you have basically a high soft state where now the photospheric radius is much larger, the photospheric temperature is much smaller, and the luminosity is much larger. So that's the basic prediction for these stripped stars. Stan, to answer your question, mass loss rate in this model during oxygen burning was about 10 to the minus 1 solar masses per year. So these are very large mass loss rates. But again, that's only in this model, the last several months of its life. So this is larger mass loss rates and lower luminosities than what I showed in New Zealand, for those of you who are there. The reason for that is I'm now trying to account for the shock damping of the waves. That makes them damp a little deeper in the star at higher densities. That increases the mass loss rate, but it decreases the amount of energy that can escape as photons, because now they're in a basically, they have to, the photons are, there's more adiabatic losses. And actually, the main thing is there's more, most of the energy is now being used to drive mass loss rather than go into photons.
Is it a one-to-one? I mean, how is this mass loss rate dependent again on the details? So that your eta, if you were to put a plot on here with different etas, what would happen?
Good question. So mass loss rate will definitely go up for higher etas and down for lower etas. I'm not sure by how much. There's a lot of things to do here. I just haven't done them all. Okay, so here's basic conclusions.
Can I ask one question? Yeah. Do you always get at least the Eddington luminosity out like was predicted by the analytic analysis?
I think so during these steady state phases when you have a steady state wind, I believe that's true, because then the star is sitting up here. When you don't have a steady state wind and the star is down here, then the results, I think, are less believable. But I think yes, it is super Eddington in those steady state winds where you have the optically thick wind. But I have not robustly checked all this.
And that does seem like a pretty robust prediction of the analysis, both that Elliot did and what I've done since.
Okay. So really, Elliot's paper on this is the one he already published, I'd say, has checked some of those things. And the physics, and that was also done with MESA, so I don't imagine a lot has changed between those calculations and these. These are just for trying to do it realistically for real stars, to make some observational predictions. So that's why, you know, there's tons of uncertainties for all this stuff, but at least there are some predictions that can hopefully be compared against data. So that's why I think this is all worthwhile. So I'll just leave up conclusions and take questions. Thanks.
When you say up to one solar mass, that's now for the increased data, right?
Yeah, that's what I got for the increased data for that red supergiant. I got almost a solar mass.
Of three.
Yep. So it might be, it's, you know, in most of my models it was quite a bit less. I've started doing a little bit of resolution testing. So what I tried doing that same model with better resolution. And as you up the resolution, you tend to get a little bit more mass loss because I think what's happening is that basically the implicit hydro can damp the velocities a little bit, especially at the surface when the shock is breaking out. So if you up the resolution and lower the time stepping, you can get a little bit more mass loss, a little bit more mass ejected. Yeah, Rich.
Jeremy, for what value of eta do you think you'll get a cat?
I don't know, I should run 8 equals 100 and see what happens.
You want to make a bet?
Yeah.
So, if you have different mass on the strip stars, do you expect the same sort of motion in the HR diagram? Or?
That's a great question. So what I'm doing right now is, so this is a star with no hydrogen. I recently did a run with just a little bit of hydrogen, so the kind of star that might look like a type 2b progenitor had like a few hundredths of a solar mass of hydrogen. And there what happened is, so you got, you know, different behavior than this, but basically the whole hydrogen envelope gets expelled for those very thin hydrogen envelopes. Yeah, and you do get some outbursts. They're not quite this crazy, but yeah, you get quite a bit of luminosity variation. So that is in contrast to what we see in type 2b supernovae, where there's at least one or two where there's not a lot of, not huge variations before core collapse in the observed luminosity. And of course, you do see this hydrogen envelope that's there at the time of core collapse. So yeah, I don't think this can be happening in type 2b progenitors, at least not at this level. So the question is, do you only see 2bs from stars that didn't have wave heating? Are these calculations way off for some reason? Does this happen in some stars, not others?
If you have generated waves, they should be present in all the source of pressure the way you don't.
So maybe there are some things that can potentially change the situation from star to star. One is rotation. The other is actually magnetic fields. So these waves can actually basically be converted into magnetic waves inside the core of the star if there's a magnetic field there. This is what we think we're seeing in some lower mass red giants. And that could happen in these red supergiants as well. Of course, we don't know the magnetic fields, but for large but reasonable magnetic field strengths, I have a plot somewhere. The magnetic fields could actually prevent the waves from propagating out. So that's another thing.
This
It's another caveat to all this. The core magnetic fields could have a big impact. Okay, I can't find it. But.
If you had a wish list of one or two multi-D calculations to be done to verify this work, what would your wish list be?
That's a great question. I think the most important, or maybe the most useful, would just be a very, you know, quantitative prediction of what the wave spectrum is for these stars at this phase of evolution. What's the spectrum of internal gravity waves generated by the convection?
Okay.
What are the wave frequencies and what are the wave angular numbers?
Okay.
Because that's...
What would make you believe a simulation of that? I'm curious, since you don't seem to believe the ones that have been done. So I'm just curious as to at what point do you believe a simulation of that?
I wouldn't say I don't believe the ones that have been done. I mean, I don't understand them all the way. So I think one thing that would be very useful is if we run these simulations and understand very well exactly what the physics is that's leading to that spectrum, and we understand that it's not being affected by the choices you have to make to run the simulations, you know, by the diffusivity profile, by the resolution, that kind of thing. So this is something I think it would be great if we could figure out, and you're obviously a great person who could help with that.
How does the ADA directly map to the spectrum?
What
or does it?
What do you mean?
Your ADA that you use to vary the wave efficiency effectively.
So this
is that a multiplier on basically the wave luminosity or the wave flux?
That's right. So all the ADA is.
Okay.
And the plots I showed is just a fudge factor. I just change this wave heating rate by eta. So I don't change the wave frequencies or anything.
Right.
There's other ways to vary it. But that was just the simplest thing to do.
What when did you say that it was not a good model for 2N supernova?
Ah, yeah. So in the conclusion, yeah. So not a good model for 2N. The reason is, at least in the hydrogen-rich models I've run, there's not enough time. Even though the wave heat is almost enough to unbind the envelope, there's not enough time to unbind it and get it to large radii of 10 to the 15 or 10 to the 16 centimeters, which is what you need to get a very luminous type 2N.
You'd have 30 years or so.
Right, you'd have to, there's just... By the time the supernova explodes, the envelope is still pretty close to the star. So I don't think it would look like a luminous 2N. Now you can get a little mass ejected. So at very early times, the spectrum might look a little bit more 2N-like, or it might look a little more like these flash ionized supernova spectra that have been seen at very early times for some 2Ps.
Because the flash ionized ones, you don't need such high masses, right? For those, you can get away with 10 to the minus 3 normal stellar winds. But for the 2Ns is where the problem
right.
is, where you need 10 to the minus 1 or so, which you cannot do with a normal wind.
Right.
So there's something extra is needed, like a super Eddington wind. So I would think your models are more suitable for the 2Ns. But maybe not the luminous ones.
I would say the most luminous ones, it's hard to get the material far enough away, at least for this 15 solar mass model. Right?
Assuming what wind speeds?
Assuming the wind speeds that are coming out of the models, which for those red supergiants are 50 kilometers per second or less.
You said that in the supergiant, it needs about a solar mass, but I don't remember you quoting a number or how much mass you lose. Integrated for the stripped model.
Okay, so for the stripped model, so I'd have to check, but I think it's we can try to integrate it.
A tenth of a solar mass, right?
Yeah, I mean it's roughly a tenth of a solar mass for roughly a year, so it's roughly roughly a tenth of a solar mass, maybe a little less. Yeah. For the red supergiant, it really depended on eta, right? Because for the low etas. What was happening is the material wasn't actually getting unbound. It was actually falling back.
Yeah.
whereas for the hiatus, the material actually was getting unbound. So I reran this green model with higher resolution, and what you actually find, you get a little bit of a tail coming off here. Higher resolution helps get a little bit of material to higher velocities as that shock breaks out of the surface. So I'd say, you know, there's lots to be done in terms of verification of these models, or validation, I forget which one's which.
What is the relative importance of the neutrino damping and the evanescent behavior in the convective shells?
So in these models, well, they're both important, right? They both affect this wave heating escape rate. So in these models, the most important damping term is this neutrino damping term. But that is, you know, that's in the same term as this evanescent tunneling integral. So they both come into play at the same level.
If you go to the next plot, so it looks like essentially the blue curve is the shifted down version of the black curve, right? By a factor of...
It's shifted down, but... So there's a couple shifts. The main shift is it shifted down by Mach number.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Then it shifted down a little bit more by this loss term.
So these losses are just of the order of a factor of 2.
For during oxygen burning, in this calculation, it's about a factor of 2. During shell burning, it's more because in this calculation now there's an extra damping term due to waves tunneling into the core. There could be, so I think another big uncertainty is there could be a third damping term here, which is a nonlinear damping term. That could potentially lower this more.
Just, I have a problem to understand the neutrino damping, perhaps. I would have thought, you know, if you squeeze a package of material, the neutrinos leak out immediately. It's not like photons where
right.
You have to wait until they come out.
That's right.
So if you compress, you don't get a back reaction. You'd say you stay in the dense state, right? Because the energy is gone immediately. So why is that not stronger?
So this is just energy loss during each of those compressions. Basically, this tells you how much energy is lost. It's true, the energy doesn't have to diffuse, it's just lost. So this, if you work this out, this is basically just a thermal time, a neutrino thermal time. It's not instantaneous. I think basically this time scale is of order the evolution time scale of the core. That's basically, it's like a neutrino thermal time scale. Waves can propagate on closer to a dynamical time scale of that core. So this term tends to be fairly small, but then this evanescent transmission coefficient is also fairly small. So this factor overall can be of order unity.
If there's no more question, let's thanks.
Right.
We have no power to tell in about inside about 500.
Yeah, I think. Understand.
Why inside about? What do you mean?
Because we only see the rise when it breaks out. It's about 4 or 5 hours or so.
Yeah. Oh, for the shock breakout. Yeah, but then there's the light curve.
Seem not to do more than a factor of 2.
So So yeah, so the shock breakout is telling you about the density out here. Yes.
Inside there's nothing, no information that's coming from.
Inside about 500 solar radii, I think that we have no information.
So yeah.
Really, you can't get an oscillation.
Yeah. So.
I mean, it's not that big.
Yeah.
3,000
solar radii. Right.
But
that's
yeah.
Like it's not far off the ring.
So, and again, actually, when I ran this with high resolution, I did get above this dot, I actually got a little tail going out here. And so that is where I would expect the shock breakout to happen. But you can also get a little tail just from the wind launching region, as Luke pointed out. So I don't know what is more important for determining that density profile above the photosphere, but this can contribute.
Some of the folks that have covered different topic, are you doing something fancy for the location of the photosphere in ways that only these aerostatic things?
No. Not doing anything fancy, but I am evolving material above the photosphere. So I evolve out to 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 4 in optical depth. So all this, so the dot is the optical depth equals 1. So there is material above that, which is optically thin.
No, I think that's nothing like the
optics. Well, I don't know, but
we had quite a lot of masses with very low optical depths.
Well, I mean, probably low optical depths, dense region in between. Surface at high optical depths. Low optical depths in between. And that certainly cannot be correct.
Well, maybe you have a similar issue. I mean, you have a just low
optical depth. Right, it happens to you. Right, it happens to you in this red curve. So the optical depth in at the low density week is probably quite low.
It means that you're very optical depth across.
Oh yeah, yeah. I looked at that. Yeah, it is. And that, it's larger than one, but it is low.
Structure we have. I mean, it's pretty close to one nowadays.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, this is getting close to optically thin here, and that's. That does weird things to the models, like this part, so you get heating here because you have this wind is shocking, is running into this overlying envelope, it's shocking, it's heating this region up, and then a lot of those photons actually diffuse in rather than out. And then they get evicted back out. No, this region's total garbage because of the Rayleigh-Taylor. Yeah.
Why do you have these spikes in the...
So these are shocks going out.
Yeah, I mean, they look like shocks, but
yeah.
So what triggers the shocks? Are those shocks triggered by pneumatics?
So I think this is a shock excited by waves during carbon shell burning number 3.
That's the rise all the way down. There's a shock structure.
It's going out. So in this model, what happened was, first there was a neon burning shock that went out and unbound some mass from the surface and made the whole thing expand. And then carbon shell burning number 3 happened after that. That excited another pressure wave, which is now going out. I think it probably has steepened into a shock at this point in this model, and that's still going out. In these models, that's what's producing the second peak here. That carbon shell burning shock is just starting to approach the surface. But that can change quite a bit, depending on the mass of, and the timing of the burning phases and all that. So I could show you a 12 solar mass model. There, the results are a bit different. Okay, so here's the 15, this is 12. So I didn't do this run extremely carefully, but here the oxygen burning lasts a lot longer and the wave heating is a lot less. So what happens is first you get this neon burning shock that goes out, and then the star is able to basically relax after that shock breaks out, and it sort of oscillates around for a while and eventually sort of relaxes back to its equilibrium state. And then oxygen burning turns on and gives you this. But you just, in this case, you have roughly one dynamical time between neon burning and core collapse. But in this case, you have many dynamical times, so you get this oscillation.
This is still radiative damping of the waves without the nonlinear.
Right. That's right. Yeah. It changes where they damp a little bit, but they still damp at that transition between helium core and hydrogen envelope. So I don't think it's going to drastically change these results, but
it makes a big difference in the strip cell, but not from the stars.
I think it'll make a bigger difference there, yeah. But it'll affect these a little bit. But I think you'll still get these pressure-driven waves going out into the envelope.
But you can't get rid of all the helium in the strip stars?
I think that would be tough. Yeah, I don't think this is a good way to make 1Cs. But what it might do is give you something sort of like a 1BN.
Mm, right.
Because you might get a tenth of a solar mass off.
Sure. Yeah.
So it might be a way to make 1BNs.
Calculations 1BNs, 2BNs? Are there rumors to this?
I don't know.
Just to say, I think all these calculations may not be quite as relevant for the mass loss, but I think they're more relevant for the structure at the time of the explosion.
Well,
which may affect then the light curve, possibly collapse in the inner region.
I think it's relevant for the mass loss in the last 10 years of evolution.
Well, I think it's more the last few years.
Yeah, so it depends on the mass. As you go to lower masses, neon burning is like 10 years before. Yeah. For this model, I think it's like 8 years before. For this model, it's 2 years before.
Well, I mean, the blue stuff, I'm not sure whether there's that much mass loss in the blue phase there.
That's right, there's not very much.
And so then you started...
It still might be 10 to the minus 3.
That's... The color code is more like 1 there.
So this is time. The color code is time. This is luminosity. This isn't telling us anything about mass loss.
No. Cares about the time
right.
When you get these excursions all around. So right. It's a traumatic thing up there in terms of luminosity setting there last year.
That's right.
Which one of the helium giant looks better for?
So like a lower mass helium star that has expanded? No. I'm not. The one I ran was about 5 solar mass helium core, so I guess it's... Yeah, so if you go a bit lower, it's expanded more. I don't know. It'd be interesting.
How much longer does it take to run a model with these things?
It's not that expensive, but it's just really tricky because the hydro can be finicky in Mesa, and so it can crash. Or it can, it can just run into problems where for some reason it runs into a problem and starts taking really small time steps. So these runs I just have to babysit, but they don't take very long. They could run in a night, but the problem is they might crash every hour. it depends. I spent a lot of time going through models and finding something that looked real. You know, making sure the model didn't do anything that looked really artificial or it didn't crash. So that takes some time. But I think as we understand how to implement this better, it'll become more fluid. It can be more automatic with less human intervention.
Ensemble of similar physical models with different numerical parameters. And A, that tells you something about the chaotic behavior, but B,
you'll get lucky sometimes and some of them will reach the end without babysitting.
Yeah.
Maybe an inefficient use of electricity, but we're saving time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, yeah, that's a great project, I think, for a graduate student.
So I think there was a little bit of, particularly in the beginning of the talk, there was, and I think you finally said it better at the end, at the beginning of the talk, you were talking about the neutrino loss rates, and
yeah.
And I think there was a little confusion there, particularly yeah. with, you know, regardless, especially even I got caught when you said, oh, well, the neutrinos come out later. And I was going, what? No, because once those thermal neutrinos happens, they're gone. They're toast.
Right. Yeah.
You.
Right.
And so saying that they're, you know, it took a delay before the neutrinos got out was, I think what you finally said it right at the end, it's the structure of the star that is taking the time to readjust. Is that right?
Well, the neutrinos...
And Norbert tried to get at this... a little bit earlier. If I compress a little bit, the neutrinos are gone, then what?
Right, but they don't radiate all the energy instantaneously. They're still some time scale to radiate energy. And that is roughly a neutrino thermal time scale.
Not in the code, though. In the code, you go L nuke minus L nu, period. End of story.
Yeah, that's how much energy is being lost. But I'm saying if you divide the heat contents divided by L nuke minus L neutrino, there's still some time scale that it takes to cool off.
For the structure.
Yeah.
The star.
Yes. Yeah. And it turns out that's roughly the same time scale on which the waves are damped.
Okay.
And that's because you don't need neutrino energy to diffuse from wave crest to wave trough. It's just you compress a region and it's gone. So waves both compress and rarefy regions. Uh-huh. You have to add those two up. There's still a net loss due to the compression.
Uh-huh.
So that's what damps the wave.
That's what I was trying to get at. So you said that the logarithmic derivative of the neutrino loss rate with temperature was like 10.
Oh, yeah,
but
roughly.
For the helium burning, it's much higher. So I wasn't getting at the convection zone. I was getting at whether it changes the integrated helium burning rate.
So I am hoping that MESA accounts for that correctly. I think stellar evolution codes get pretty close.
It doesn't do the temperature perturbation of the wave traveling through the
No.
Network.
No, it doesn't do that.
Thinking about the neutrinos.
That's right.
It's the same effect, isn't it?
What do you mean it's the same effect?
So you have a region and you have a temperature perturbation and fluctuation.
Right.
It's changing the mean neutrino loss rate. Right?
That's right.
Symmetric. And the same is happening presumably with the helium burning
zone. Yeah. So I'm only...
I'm not saying you're getting the right answer, I'm just saying it's an interesting potential physical effect, but it's not included.
But it's a percent effect, though, because the...
If it's important for the neutrino losses, when the exponent with respect to temperature perturbations is only 10, it should be even more important when the exponent with respect to temperature perturbations is 40, which is 40.
Yeah, but the neutrino, the thermal time scale is much longer out there. So even if the exponent is larger, the other terms...
That term. Right.
Right, so this term is much smaller, though.
Yeah.
Even if...
Much smaller.
So this is strongly, in the runs I've done, this is peaked just outside of the convective core. That's where the densities are largest, and this thermal timescale is the shortest. Right? Because neutrinos are... mostly radiated by those dense hot regions. So that's where most of the neutrino damping is. It's just above the core.
Right. Uh-huh. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Just above the convective core in the radiative region where the waves are propagating.
That makes sense. You're saying the neutrino loss rate is higher because of the propagation of the waves.
Well, that's where the neutrino loss rate in general is largest.
You always cool larger off-center than you do in the center.
Right.
Yeah,
off-center cooling.
Right. And that's what allows you to get convection in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jim, you've studied the connection between internal gravity waves and angular momentum transport, and which fraction of this energy do you think is going to be lost in coherent rotational motion?
I think little for the stuff going out. Yeah, so some of the energy can go into kinetic energy instead of thermal energy when the waves damp. I don't think much is going to go into rotation on the way out because those waves are acoustic waves. Those have group velocities close to radially outwards. Right, so then...
Sometimes I try to rely on... our intuition.
Yeah.
And if you were to estimate the dumping of ocean waves produced by an earthquake somewhere or a volcano, and would you conclude that would you reach the right conclusion as the wave breaks on the sea, does it make a tsunami or does it make sun waves or does it melt the
right.
It's so large that the rock melts, or would you think of disrupting pebbles into sand? Or,
it's up to you to make the experiment to verify. Well,
I think it's a good toy example to check your intuition.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying you've missed the pebbles.
No, there could be physics I've missed.
But certainly the kinetic energies can be an actor, as you advocated in the center. So why is it missing here? Or why is it neglected?
Which kinetic energy?
The large-scale kinetic energy, such as rotational motions, I mean, before generating acoustic waves.
For generating acoustic waves. Well. So when the waves are just bouncing around as gravity waves, they're basically the kinetic energy is just in the waves. The waves essentially generate what's called it's this wave flow duality, where it's like, do you say the energy is in the waves or in the main flow they induce?
I think the ingredient why it worked in the core and not in the...
So, the main thing is, I think here a lot of the wave energy is not damping. The waves are just bouncing around. Of course, some of their energy is damped by neutrinos. And so that will impart some mean flow to this region, which I haven't calculated in these models. It's easier to affect, so in that other paper where I look at the waves going into the core, that's when you had a convective shell burning phase. The waves go into the core, they non-linearly break, and they deposit their energy and momentum. But in that case, the moment of inertia of that core is pretty small. So it's affected a lot by that wave momentum.
Yeah, but here, we're not saying that the momentum will be large. I just questioning that I took some energy, some significant energy from the waves.
So the waves that dampen here probably will deposit some momentum, especially angular momentum in here. And that might stochastically change the rotation rate in this region, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not so much worried about the consequence on the rotation rate, but rather as a possible loss term that you would have detected.
The flow itself doesn't necessarily create a loss term. You create a flow because of losses. That can then feed back on the wave propagation.
Yeah, but in a sense, your 1D picture reflects this transverse motion. Neglects this possible outcome of the energy.
So the waves, I mean, the waves don't generate any background transverse motion unless they damp.
Yes. and they damp.
They do damp a little bit. So yeah, the transverse motion, there will be some transverse motion excited in this layer. If that transverse circulation frequency becomes comparable to the wave frequencies, then it will strongly affect their propagation.
Yeah, but before reaching this stage, you're saying that you didn't neglect this. I mean, this, you're saying this does not add a damping.
I don't think it adds a damping term, no. Waves can propagate into regions with flows. That doesn't damp the waves. It does change their wavelength and group velocity and things like that. But it doesn't damp them. At least.
I'm discussing whether the gravity modes can induce differential rotation, for example.
Yeah. I think they could to some extent.
Then there's some energy to that.
Right. But they only induce rotation if they damp.
But can your waves do that? In 1D, I guess it's, they don't have the possibility to damp in that way.
Well, you could add a mean flow acceleration term that changes the rotation rate, for instance, in these shells of the star. I could try to add that in.
What you're saying is that they couple to acoustic waves.
Yeah.
Still in their linear regime. They don't.
Right, that's, yeah.
They're still far from breaking.
And that's right.
And it's only those acoustic waves which will reach some breaking further out.
That's right. Yeah, so you can think of generating an acoustic wave right here at the edge of this evanescent region. That goes out. And actually the heating, where this wave actually damps, is actually right here. That's what creates this little dip.
So this crossing of the helium shell will just inject energy on smaller scales?
So I don't know. Well, yeah, how does this wave interact with the convective eddies in this shell? As this evanescent, because it's an evanescent wave at this point.
It's like going through an inhomogeneous medium. It's a,
yeah.
As you said, it's a steady medium.
Right.
The potential is short.
Right.
It's an inhomogeneous medium, so you're going to disperse to smaller scales.
It's inhomogeneous, but the Mach numbers here are small. So the density perturbations produced by convection are very small. Those goes as Mach number squared. So yes, it's inhomogeneous, but it's not very inhomogeneous. Yes, but those are small because, again, it's low Mach number convection. So there are inhomogeneities, but they're small. Still, it might be an important effect.
In the onion skin model for massive stars in the final phases, we have this multitude of convective shells. And so you only talk about the helium shell. Are the others just not relevant?
So I guess I've really mostly just focused on neon and oxygen burning as you go to for this one mass, right? As you go to later phases, things get more complicated. I haven't tried to go through this stage and try to come up with something I really believe.
The neon supply could be motivated also by carbon conversion.
That's right. It could be, yeah. But I think, so what you can show is that what's important for controlling the waves is the thickest evanescent region. So like, yeah, for instance, during neon burning here, there is a little carbon shell burning is just starting, so there is a little convective evanescent region right here. But it's really thin. And so, yeah, it can reflect some waves, but basically the waves will end up, really what really bottles the waves in is this much thicker convective region. So I go through that in my derivation of how much wave heat gets out, I account for multiple evanescent regions. But what dominates, you can show what dominates is the thickest convective region. It's sort of like a series of resistors, and what dominates the resistance is just the biggest resistor.
Equally with the density profile, of course, we have some steps also at the location of the shell sources.
Sorry, say that again? You have what?
You advocated that you get the largest breaking where you have some big drops in density.
Yeah.
And the biggest one is, of course, you know, at the
it's right here.
Hydrogen shell. What's the convective envelope? But you have some steps before as well. The location of the other burning shells.
Yeah.
But again, the effect of those are not strong enough density drops to make a wave break.
I don't think so, no. No, I don't. The density, really, where it really changes is right here, right? And this is, so the waves are excited here, and they're propagating in here. The density doesn't change that much. I mean, it does. The wave amplitudes are certainly larger out here, but I don't think it's enough to create breaking. Then this region, they're evanescent, and then they start propagating somewhere around here. And then they hit this cliff.
So that is determined by this equation, which has a density cube.
Yeah. So actually, so this is a damping mass, but this is calculated with the radiative of diffusion. It goes down a little bit if you account for shock formation, because the acoustic waves can form shocks. And that lowers it a little bit, and it basically moves the wave heating location in just a little bit. Yeah.
I don't understand why you assess the effect of this helium shell by the value of the Mach number. It's not the Mach number which is important. Qualify the non-linearity of this region.
It's the Mach number that tells you how big the perturbations from the background are.
From the acoustic point of view, but you're not dealing with acoustic waves
then. Okay, so I don't see what you're getting at.
Well, so the fact that it is a non-linear region, non-linear convective region, tells you that the amplitude of the motions are much bigger than the linear wave that you're trying to propagate through it. So it's not necessarily, I mean...
I'm not sure that's true. What would be interesting to compare is the wave velocity from the waves that are tunneling through compared to the convective velocities in that shell. It'd be an interesting comparison. I'm not sure which one is bigger.
If they're comparable, would you not expect some sort of lambda damping then?
Can you explain that?
Resonance.
So there's definitely a time scale separation that I think is going to. There's no resonance in terms of frequencies.
No finding scale. You have a range of frequencies.
Well, so the lower frequency waves. Trying to think if I have a good plot that shows any of this. Actually, in the movie. Look in the movie.
Hungry?
Well,
if it were incompressible, you wouldn't worry about the sound field. I still worry about forcing a turbulent, I mean a convective.
Okay, so let's look at, so this is my convective turnover frequencies, this blue line. So waves are at about this frequency. So that's higher frequency than the convective turnover times than any of these other convective shells. So there is definitely a frequency mismatch.
Yeah, this was clear, as you said. Uh-huh. It was more or less frozen, but I'm talking of the space in homogeneities.
Uh-huh.
You cross, it's like crossing, when you want to damp waves in the sea, you put some obstacles and the waves are suddenly diffracted into smaller waves, but there is no frequency matching at all, it's just a space And I think the Mach number is not the quantity to wonder whether these homogeneities are efficient or not.
I think it is the density contrast away from the background. That's what scatters waves. But that also, the Mach number of the convection tells you how large the density differences are between different parts of the convective flow.
If you take incompressible water with a turbulent flow, where the velocity of the turbulent flow has nothing to do with the acoustic waves, it's just measure the velocities.
Yeah.
And you try to propagate a wave, a large scale wave, through this turbulent flow, then your wave may or not cross this turbulent flow, but this is not the Mach number criteria.
What will the wave see? I mean, you would see density fluctuation in water, you don't have any, right?
They see orthotropy and vorticity fluctuations.
You could certainly model that as like a turbulent viscosity that damps the waves. Maybe that.
For example, yeah.
Yeah.
From the space point of view, for example.
Right. So that effectively, a turbulent viscosity like that is what damps acoustic waves and red giants.
This is not acoustic, right? I mean, this is not.
Well, so here the wave is evanescent in that region, so it's less susceptible to an effective viscosity because its wavelength is fairly long, right? So there's the viscous damping time scale would be like a wave number squared times a effective turbulent viscosity. I don't think that's important because originally that was one of the things that I damped my waves with in the hydrogen envelope, and that turns out to be less important than radiative diffusion and shock formation in the hydrogen envelope. I'm not sure if I ever calculated that in the helium convective shell. But maybe we could estimate it. So if it's about kr squared times the turbulent viscosity. So in those evanescent shells, Kr is about 1 over r squared. Turbulent viscosity is on the order of h times velocity. Does this sound reasonable so far? So what are my convective velocities in my helium shell? This yellow line, let's be generous and call it 10 to the 6. What's the scale height? probably of order 10 to the minus 1 solar radii.
Yeah.
Let's just call H is about R.
That's another way to do it. Alpha times R.
Recon over R. This is about 10 to the 6 over, say, 10 to the 10.
Yeah.
In that helium burning shell, something like that. That's about 10 to the minus 4 per second. So the wave is evanescent there, so it doesn't have a well-defined group velocity through that region. But I think it's effectively a pressure disturbance. I think it more or less goes through at a sound speed. Through that region. So the question is this gamma larger than the time it takes the wave to propagate through that region? I think for an evanescent wave, that propagation timescale is roughly a dynamical timescale across that region. Which for a helium, let's see, so 10 to the minus, what's the sound speed? Anybody know the sound speed? So a dynamical time, well, a dynamical 10 time
10 to 7.
Is basically just sound speed divided by radius, right? So that means gamma over gamma dyne. So that's a small number. That's a Mach number of this helium convection. So that's 10 to the minus 3 or something. So I think... I don't think that's going to be a big damping effect.
The time scale is 10 to 4 seconds, right?
Yeah.
And that's pretty long.
It's pretty long. I mean, the waves might bounce around for 10 to the 4 seconds, but they're bouncing around, and most of that time is spent propagating in these radiative regions.
I would have added that to your wish list of 2D calculations. Just if you have a turbulent layer, and this gets what Tyr is getting after, if you have a turbulent layer and you hit it with a wave, you get a frequency or a spectrum, what do you get out of the other side?
Right. Yeah, so I'd say, you know, this process for calculating wave tunneling and all that works extremely well for the low mass red giants. That's why we were able to calculate the suppressed mode visibilities if waves are damped in the core. It's basically this exact same calculation. So there, I'd say it works very well.
Okay. Fair enough.
But maybe there's some different physics here. But that wish list for 2D sim or 3D sims is very long. I guess there's lots of steps. It can't all be done at once. The range of, especially in a red supergiant, you're going from densities of 10 to the 7 to 10 to the minus 10.
It's tough.
You're not going to be able to simulate all of that at the same time. But maybe different steps of it you could simulate.
Stuff.
Yeah, thanks for talking through all this with me.
Safe by 2 orders for me.
Okay.
If it's the accuracy type.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. If it's the one by star.
Well, the brunt, though, there is imaginary.
CT time scale associated to buoyancy, but I don't know, I'm not sure, I don't know why it should be one or the other. If it were acoustic waves, of course, it could be the acoustic time. For this kind of wave, you know better than me.
Well, they're not really waves. You're, now they're evanescent.
They are, so I don't know. But even for acoustic waves, acoustic waves through an acoustic, through an evanescent region, they would, I mean, I would safely say that the causality is limited by the sound speed. I would do the same with light waves across evanescent region.
So it might actually be a better time scale, might actually be basically a wave time, basically just omega. So, you know, the phase speed is like omega r. So that it might really be more of like a phase speed. That's really the effective time scale. So, so omega r might be sort of the crossing time for the wave across that region. Across a region of width roughly r is going to be, so the crossing time scale, or crossing frequency, if it's not a dynamical time scale, it's about a wave frequency.